Dr. Haymack mentioned the ATLAS trial of maintenance gefitinib that was presented in an oral ASCO session by Dr. Vince Miller, who met with me to discuss this data set and others with implications for clinical practice. Dr. Miller began by reviewing the design of the ATLAS trial.
ATLAS was a study which takes Avastin eligible patients, and the investigators gave four cycles of a platinum-based doublet with Avastin. And then after completion of the cytotoxic portion of their therapy, individuals who had not progressed were randomized to treatment with erlotinib or placebo. And the hypothesis was several-fold. It started with the backbone regimen derived from ECOG 4599, that if one adds bevacizumab to chemo, you do better than the chemotherapy alone. Several small studies, along with preclinical data, had suggested that adding erlotinib to bevacizumab did better than either agent alone. So it was pretty well-founded. The primary endpoint of the trial was progression-free survival, and the study had 80% power to detect a 25% improvement in median progression-free survival. And as we saw from a number of these studies, it's really important not just to look at that one point on the curve, the median, but to look at the log rank test, which reflects the totality of the curve, how things were behaving over time. And so in my slides, I tried to show the proportion of patients who were progression-free at 3 months and 6 months, and talk about those who were progression-free at a year, because I think that's more palpable to the practicing oncologists, not to hear that there's a two-week difference or a four-week difference or a five-week difference in median PFS, but to think about their patient reaching some benchmark, some life event, because they lived a year or went a year without progressing, as opposed to as if they had not taken a particular combination of therapies. We showed that the median progression-free survival was improved by slightly over a month, 3.75 to 4.8 months. And we also showed a hazard ratio of 0.72 for in favor of the combination arm. And the curves look pretty robust. There's a clear separation early in the progression-free proportion of patients at given time points that sustains over time. The number of patients who were added a year or could be evaluated at a year benchmark at the time of the analysis was small, but the difference appeared to be obtaining. So I thought this was a very interesting and encouraging result.
Now, do you have EGFR mutation status on these patients?
You know, this trial was not written to be primarily a biomarker trial, but there is tissue on more than half the patients, I'm told, and that analysis is ongoing to look at different biomarkers. And we'll see in which group it helped the most. Certainly, I did show some forest plots for different clinical variables, and certainly the additive power of erlotinib appeared incredibly impressive in the subset of patients who were never smokers and the small number of patients with Asians, sort of pointing to the same story.
Do you think that the trial might have been enriched for patients more likely to respond to a TKI just by patient selection to enter the trial?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that if one looks at the countries where it was accrued, that's not necessarily the case. There wasn't a big Asian contingent. And if you look at the proportion of patients who were never smokers, it was about 15 to 17%, which is inordinately high for the countries involved. And I'd also conjecture that some of those patients, at least based on some practice patterns, who were really felt to be sensitive to these drugs might have gotten the drug in first line. So I don't think there'll be a disproportionate bias to patients likely to benefit from EGFR TKI therapy. I think this is really a clinically driven trial and not so much even thought of in terms of biomarkers by many of the enrolling physicians.
What are the clinical implications in terms of practical management of patients right now? Obviously, both of these biologics are available. In what situation do you think this strategy might be considered?
To me, there are different situations in which one could envision undertaking this strategy. But certainly, I think one of the consensus is this was not a uniformly applicable strategy unless we see some survival benefit, some clear survival benefit to the combination. And the number of events that were available at the time of analysis were far too small to comment on survival, but it is expected by year's end. In my mind, if you have someone going along on maintenance or about to start maintenance therapy with bevacizumab, and yet their cancer responded somewhat or partially, yet they remain symptomatic from their disease, that's the setting in which one might look at this strategy. Gee, my patient's still got a good performance status. He's been through the tough times of chemo, but he still has a symptomatic burden from his disease that would like to lessen. He's in pain. He's short of breath. He's losing weight. What can I do? And then I think the question comes in, well, can I add something to bevacizumab And, you know, you saw data that adding erlotinib delays progression. You do see some responses, and implicit in that is that some of the cancer-related symptoms in some of the patients will improve.
And in terms of side effects and tolerability, I guess it's pretty much just adding one plus one. They're not really overlapping.
I think that's exactly the way to put it. There were no surprises. One and one was two, it wasn't three.
And what about this issue of the use of erlotinib bevacizumab without chemotherapy?
Well, I don't think we have first-line data on it. We certainly have a good body of data now in erlotinib and bevacizumab. We have the beta lung trial where the combination was compared to erlotinib alone. We have the ATLAS trial where the combination was compared to bevacizumab and placebo. We have the Saturn trial where erlotinib was compared to placebo. And I think that absent, say, a genotype-driven strategy, that chemotherapy is the way to go first line.
To what extent do you think this is analogous to the data that was reported by Belani looking at pemetrexed maintenance, or some people called it early second-line therapy? Or do you think that, in a sense, this is a similar strategy?
I think the theme is the same. I'd like to take a step back, because I know you've thought a lot about breast cancer and other tumors over the years. You know, when I grew up in this field, we gave, you know, we used certain chemos where maybe the platinum part of it was hard, but the other component drug was easy to give continuously. And we'd give, say, vinblastine every 2 weeks, for example, as what might be dubbed now that fancy name of maintenance therapy. And I was never convinced that, despite a couple of papers that suggested it, that giving an arbitrary number of cycles of chemotherapy, as opposed to investigators' best informed discretion, was a superior way to go. So to me, I think we are back in part readdressing some of these issues, perhaps in a slightly different way. There are a couple of distinctions. So in the trial Dr. Belani presented, of course, patients started with a non-pemetrexed-containing regimen. So I would call that indeed early second-line therapy, i.e. a new agent was introduced, but before the time of progression. Whereas the ATLAS trial, in which individuals continued on bevacizumab, i.e. a maintenance, a component of their overall regimen, and then a new drug was added in, or erlotinib, is really a hybrid between maintenance and early second line. So I think it's important to define the terms, too, when we have these discussions.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about the other papers that you were involved with presenting at ASCO?
So I think that, you know, one of the themes of our group's work has been to continue to follow the EGFR theme and biology and to see where that leads us to other discoveries and other targets. So one of our big efforts in conjunction with William Pao, is now at Vanderbilt, was to rebiopsy patients who'd shown profound sensitivity to the EGFR TKIs at the time at which they progressed and try to determine what was causing their treatment failure. So one of the abstracts, one of our molecular pathology fellows, Dr. Arcila, A-R-C-I-L-A, presented, really was a beautiful presentation of what we've been able to accomplish in 4+ years of resequencing patients who'd failed TKI therapy after initial benefit. And these patients were really a combination of those who had a biopsy done solely for research purposes under the auspices of an IRB-approved protocol, or those who had a procedure performed for another reason where there was leftover tissue, for example, a large volume thoracentesis for therapeutic purposes, and additional material sent for diagnostic study and research study. In that case, the individual signed a different protocol. But we showed first that this is feasible, that we could get more than 130 specimens from about 118 patients over a 4-year period. We showed, I think, one of the most pivotal questions that comes up is what is the maintenance or integrity or reproducibility of an EGFR mutation? That is, if Mr. Smith had his lung cancer resected in 2003, and recurs in 2009, and he has a fine needle aspiration of tumor in 2009, can we use that archival specimen to genotype him accurately? And in the work Dr. Arcila presented, we had 55 patients who had paired specimens, i.e. an archival one and one at the time of treatment failure. 54 of 55 had the exact same EGFR mutation present. I think that's, you know, a remarkable result and very, very reassuring. Of course, those tumors have other abnormalities or the patient wouldn't have progressed. But as far as the baseline being adequate for testing, the answer is indisputable, yes, it is adequate to determine the presence or absence of an EGFR sensitizing mutation.
I think it's still kind of weird that people don't routinely have that test and others done when they have their cancer removed.
I think it's coming, Neil. I think we're in a watershed just like in melanoma. You know, I think melanoma is going to follow us.
I mean, I guess you can say, well, why don't we just wait until they have a cancer recurrence and then we can send the test. But I mean, in breast cancer, we don't do that.
No, I don't like that because then, you know, sometimes you're looking for archival material. The patient, even if they're wrong, is so riddled with anxiety that they have to start treating with tomorrow. It's great just to be able to pull a result out of the chart and say, all right, well, we had your tumor in 2006, you didn't have an EGFR mutation, and you had a KRAS mutation, so in my opinion, we should not be looking at erlotinib as a treatment option, that sort of thing, or we should make it a lower priority. I fully agree with you. Why not get the information when we can, when we're not under the pressures of time, when the issue's fresh in our minds, and go from there?
What about KRAS?
KRAS mutants are about 35 to 40% of adenocarcinomas of the lung.
And how about the other non-small cells?
Most studies say they're quite uncommon in the other non-small cells. There was a presentation that says the frequency of KRAS mutations in squamous cell tumors could be as high as 10%, but the most commonly observed number is 1% to 2% of squamous cell tumors have KRAS mutations.
I don't know how many investigators are doing this, but my understanding is that you generally don't use erlotinib or EGFR TKI therapy in a patient. You test for KRAS, and if it's positive, you don't use it?
Well, that's somewhat a contentious area, but I think that you summarize our general philosophy well, that the chance of an objective response is quite low, and certainly the drug gets prioritized if it's used. It is used at a much later course in the illness, and we generally focus on either relevant clinical trials if they're available or triaging the patient to a variety of cytotoxic agents or combinations. There are some data that, to give a balanced presentation, do conflict or at least partially conflict with our interpretation of things. In the Saturn trial, in a forest plot, and that was a biomarker-driven trial, patients with KRAS mutations did appear to benefit from erlotinib more than those treated with placebo. But I think that generally one has to bear in mind that the drug was targeted for EGFR when it was developed. It wasn't targeted for KRAS or P53 or PI3 kinase or BRAF. So in theory, it shows exactly the properties one would like from a targeted therapy. It works when the target is present and aberrant, and it doesn't work when a different target drove the tumor's maintenance and propagation.
You also had a couple of papers you were involved with at ASCO looking at another new agent, BIBW2992. What's that and what did you find?
So 2992 is a dual inhibitor of EGFR and HER2. It binds irreversibly in that ATP binding pocket as opposed to erlotinib or gefitinib, which bind reversibly. And preclinically, it has activity against what we call the T790M mutant, the gatekeeper mutation or resistance mutation that arises commonly in the EGFR-addicted patients when they fail treatment. So I think conceptually these drugs have been developed for two purposes. One is, do they have a role in breast cancer? And two is, or perhaps one, depending on your perspective, is what is their role in acquired resistance in EGFR mutant lung cancer?
In a way, it kind of sounds a little bit like lapatinib in that it's both EGFR and HER2.
It does. The issue is that it does bind covalently to the ATP binding site, unlike lapatinib. And therefore, at least preclinically, that may be the reason that it appears better against the mutant lung cancers than lapatinib.
And it's interesting, I guess, now that I think about it, are there a lot of non-competitive TKI inhibitors out there, or any, other than this one?
This binds irreversibly to EGFR and HER2. Of course, erlotinib is relatively selective for EGFR. Gefitinib is relatively selective for EGFR. Lapatinib inhibits the EGFR and HER2.
But are they all irreversible?
No. A number of them are reversible. The irreversible ones, one of the other agents is HKI-272 or neratinib, which has been reported in lung cancer and I believe has also been looked at in breast cancer.
Yeah, I've heard about it in breast cancer. So what did you see with these two reports?
So these are two trials. One is much more mature than the other. One said, how active is this drug in patients with EGFR mutations who have not received a kinase inhibitor before? That's a phase 2 trial. And the second, what's called the trial 23, is a trial which tries to salvage patients who've had sensitivity to gefitinib or erlotinib and then progressed, and randomizes these patients to either BIVW2992 or placebo in a 2-to-1 fashion.
So what did you see with these two studies?
So in the phase 2 study in patients with activating mutations, we saw a very nice response rate and progression-free survival. I think that the results clearly make this a player in the field.
Do they look sort of comparable to what you see indirectly with erlotinib?
I think they look in the same ballpark. Now, obviously, we had some, you know, higher expectations for this drug if we think we're going to salvage erlotinib failures, but I think it's hard to interpret too much across studies. I think that we'll need a little more cleaned PFS data, and we'll need to look at a breakdown of the behavior of the different tumors based on what mutation they harbored. So it may be that in 19 and 21, this drug looks better or looks the same because those are very sensitive. And in the atypical mutations that were included in this study, this drug might appear better than anecdotes or the historical controls treated with the more conventional TKIs.
Now, what about the other group of patients who'd progressed on erlotinib?
Yeah, so that's a real challenging group right now. That's analogous to finding we're looking for our dasatinib, say, after initial imatinib treatment in CML. And this is a trial. It's a phase 3 trial. The results are unknown. The trial's not completed accrual. But because tissue is hard to obtain routinely at baseline, and much of the accrual in this study is in Asia, we used for eligibility what I would call a poor man's surrogate for an EGFR mutation, which is 12 weeks or more of non-progression. And that will include a lot of different patient types. That's not foolproof for true oncogene addiction and an EGFR activating mutation. You'll have patients in there with KRAS mutations. You'll have patients in there with neither. Nonetheless, every effort, of course, is made to obtain tissue when it does exist on the patients treated in this study. But this is a survival trial. There's no crossover. The majority of it is being done in Asia, as you probably saw from the poster. And we would certainly be hopeful that we'd have some results for that maybe at next year's meeting.
Are objective responses seen in patients who have progression on erlotinib?
That's a great question. That's sort of a loaded question. So the population of patients who've had erlotinib previously and had a very good result are still somewhat variable in their composition. So I'll give you a couple of scenarios. Someone who is on erlotinib, great response, year later progresses, the doc stops erlotinib, cancer grows. Well, I can tell you that there's a very high likelihood that if you got a CAT scan at that day, you know, say day zero, and then restarted erlotinib, you would see some reshrinkage of tumor because part of that tumor burden is still erlotinib sensitive. Conversely, you might come in with a new drug like BIVW2992 or any others, not to pick on anyone, and see a good response. And in that setting, one wouldn't know whether the response were due to some inherent property of the 2992 or just going back in and using a kinase inhibitor, which was still effective in a significant subpopulation of the tumor. So that's an area we've been working a lot on, trying to standardize some criteria for entry into these trials so that we don't either miss signals for active drugs or overcall what might otherwise be inactive drugs.
What about side effects and toxicity with 2992?
I think they're class-specific, diarrhea, rash. And just parenthetically, you may have noticed the dose is different in these two studies that we finished with. In the patients who'd not received a kinase inhibitor before, the dose was amended to be lowered from 50 to 40 milligrams because of GI side effects and some associated dehydration. And that's a much better tolerated dose. Whereas in the trial in acquired resistance, we left the dose at 50. The reason the dose was left at 50 milligrams in the latter trial was twofold. One is the patients have already been on a kinase inhibitor for a long time, so they've had tachyphylaxis to some of the common adverse events. And two is for we think you need higher drug concentrations to overcome acquired resistance. So there was a rational reason to change the dose in one study and not in the other.
One of my favorite papers at ASCO this year was the TOGA study looking at trastuzumab and gastric cancer with, wow, it was a positive result. I couldn't believe
it. Yes, so that's a great point. Smart minds think alike. We actually, one of our faculty, a junior faculty, she's a fellow this year and won an award for a proposal regarding BIBW2992. She's going to join the GI service next year and approach the sponsor about making 2992 available for esophageal cancer.
Well, I was just wondering, what do we know? I mean, you mentioned that it does interact with the HER2 receptor. Any reason to think that part of its actual anti-tumor effect, or maybe just...
It may be. No, we're trying to examine that in lung cancer because we've seen some interesting results preclinically that weren't seen, say, with an erlotinib doing the exact same things with erlotinib. So we're certainly trying to examine that. There is a trial that's open, I believe, internationally for patients with HER2 mutant tumors with this agent, and the rumor is there are some very good responses on that trial, and it'll be presented at the lung cancer meeting in late July.
I was surprised. You know, I sort of had seemed like I'd heard that HER2 positivity was very uncommon, and yet they reported, at least in that series, 22% of patients had HER2 positive gastric tumors. Do you know what it is for lung cancer?
Yeah, so many moons ago, we did a randomized phase 2 of TRAS with paclitaxel or TRAS with docetaxel, and we used IHC as the test. And I believe we had some fish results also. It is a real number. It's not common, but it's probably about 10%, 10 to 15% might be 3+ by IHC standards. But we're looking at revisiting this for a couple of studies as we go forward.
So you did a study on trastuzumab in lung cancer?
It was a randomized phase 2. It was published by Lee Krug, one of my colleagues in cancer. It was not a monotherapy trial. It was combined with a taxane. So we saw activity, but it was nothing that met a predetermined threshold that it was clearly better than, or suggested to be better than, taxane alone in that population.
So getting back to 2992, anything else that's come out recently, and where is it heading?
Well, so I think we need the results of the pivotal trial, this phase 3 trial, and hopefully it does something in these patients with acquired resistance, because we really need something for those folks. We have a proposal for a couple other studies. I think there's a study planned where the drug will be compared, it will be analogous to the IPAS study, with the exception that you'll do your genotyping beforehand, and so patients with the EGFR activating mutations will be randomized to either chemotherapy or 2992, and the primary endpoint will be PFS. So I think it's headed into a first-line trial.
Interesting. So like IPAS 2 sort of, huh?
Except the patients will have to have the mutation to get on the study, whereas IPAS, of course, less than half the patients had tissue.
Wow, interesting. Let's talk about the three cases that you brought to discuss. First, the 82-year-old woman.
So the first lady is a never smoker I saw recently who was found to have two lung lesions, one on the left, looked like a peripheral lesion, maybe 2.5 centimeters, and one on the right, there was a peripheral lesion, but there was also some suggestion of hyaluronopathy on the right. And I believe both lung lesions had been biopsied and showed adenocarcinoma before she came to see me. And these were done via fine needle aspirations, but with cell blocks obtained. And the presumption was indeed that she had stage 4 disease and should get chemotherapy.
Can you talk a little bit more about her and what sort of condition she was, comorbidities?
Yeah, this lady had a good performance status. She, you know, our patients who are never smokers generally are in such better shape than those we commonly see, the patients who either were smokers or are smokers. So she had good lung function. And although 82 was certainly up for probably more than she wanted, you know, I think she'd been given the impression that she clearly had stage 4 disease. And although that might have been the scenario, we did try to explain that you might also have what's called synchronous primary tumors, where you have a tumor arise in one lung and a tumor arise in the other lung, and they're independent events and should be thought about separately.
I mean, theoretically, just in general, would she have been a thoracotomy candidate?
Yes.
So what happened?
So what we did was, you know, I saw these adenocarcinomas from both sides. On the other hand, the thing that was unusual is there was nothing in the mediastinum. And so I said, well, why don't we genotype both tumors? So we genotyped the one on the left, and there was no EGFR mutation. And we genotyped the one on the right, and she had an EGFR mutation.
Which one?
She had an exon 21 mutation in the tumor on the right. So this is as close as we get to being on CSI, you know, in Miami in 2009. We sort of fingerprinted the tumors, and granted there could be some false positives or negatives, but pretty much established these were separate tumors.
I can't even guess what you did.
Well, there are probably many different ways to cut it, so to speak, but we had her see a thoracic surgeon about the possibility of a resection on the left side. And we also had her see one of our interventional radiologists, see if the tumor on the left was amenable to either radiofrequency ablation or cryotherapy. The right side, of course, is more complicated because there's a hilar node involved. So that could not be amenable to a local procedure such as cryotherapy or radiofrequency ablation, but would be more appropriately addressed with a surgical procedure. So where we stand currently, Neil, is that she has opted for no surgery on the left and to get a radiofrequency ablation, where the early results for control of small lung cancers look pretty good, similar to what one would get with radiation or surgery. And then she's going to come back and see me, and we're going to discuss using Tarceva for a while for the EGFR mutated tumor, seeing how she does, and then considering whether we should do a lobectomy and mediastinal nodal dissection for that slightly more advanced tumor, at least by clinical staging criteria.
Interesting. How about your 62-year-old lady?
So this is a very nice lady who works at Princeton, and she came to see me from an oncologist I know in that area. And she had had resection of a T1 N0 adenocarcinoma about a year and a half before there were signs of tumor recurrence. And she had a very well-done surgery by a very well-respected thoracic surgeon. This was a small tumor, maybe 2 centimeters, 1.5 centimeters. And he took out about 40-some-odd nodes, and there was no sign of cancer in those nodes.
Was she a smoker?
This lady was a 20-pack year smoker.
So what happened with this lady?
So this lady, unfortunately, on routine imaging, follow-up CAT scans to see if there were any sign of recurrence, was found to have lesions in her bone, multiple sites in her bone, and she underwent a biopsy of one of these, which confirmed adenocarcinoma, and what was compared to her original tumor from 14, 15 months before, it looked morphologically identical. There was nothing to suggest that there was a new primary tumor anywhere. She was up to date on screening. She was very meticulous about her health care. She was advised to commence therapy with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, and she came to see me at the recommendation of her treating oncologist to see what we thought before she embarked on that treatment.
So this is just a few months after her surgery.
This had been 9 months later. Yeah, it was a very short period, especially for such a early stage tumor. Very disappointing result for the patient, and I'm sure anyone involved in her care.
So somehow I think this is leading into her tumor getting genotyped.
It is. So we said you have an asymptomatic recurrence. You have disease in bone, which historically is challenging to treat, doesn't work so well with chemo. And we know you had your whole tumor taken out a year ago. It's not like we have a paucity of tissue. And her medical oncologist, a very savvy guy, had already actually sent her tumor to a lab in California that does some of these tests. And he had a KRAS result that showed non-mutated. He had an ERCC1 result. I think he had an RRM1 result. And he had an EGFR FISH result. But he didn't have an EGFR mutation result. And upon speaking with me on the phone after we saw her, he called the vendor and said, "Can't you get this EGFR mutation test?" And they said, "Yes." And lo and behold, it was a relatively happy day for all involved because she did have an EGFR, I believe, exon 19 deletion.
How often do you see that? Now, she was an ex-smoker.
So we've published that there's a fairly nice or predictable relationship between the number of pack years smoked and the likelihood of tumor harboring an EGFR mutation. So, of course, never smokers have about a 50% chance of an EGFR mutation. 15 pack years, you have about a 25% chance of an EGFR mutation. And she was 20 pack years, she probably had a 10-12% chance of having an EGFR mutation. But why not take the time and learn and be certain? And I think those are exactly the patients we need to look harder in, because we're probably missing them, assuming none of them have EGFR mutations.
And I guess based on IPAS and a lot of other things, you start on erlotinib.
Yeah. So I said, why don't we take erlotinib, give you a bisphosphonate, and I think you'll be happier and do better than if we had to resort to chemotherapy initially.
How's she doing?
The last report is everybody was happy and she was doing well. Of course, a little challenging to assess response in bone, especially lesions that are asymptomatic. So I think it's really important to follow those patients with the same modality one had at baseline, not to, say, jump in with a bone scan when the patient hasn't had one in 2 years.
What about your 38-year-old woman?
Yeah, I presented this case because it's not the same as the other two, and it's a little bit humbling and it's a little bit hard to explain. But this was a 38-year-old never smoker who came to see me with floridly metastatic disease, brain mets, bone mets, soft tissue mets, adrenal, liver, kidney. And she had been genotyped for EGFR and KRAS and had no mutation. And prior to being genotyped, and this lady, there was a rush to start her treatment because she was so symptomatic. We said, we'll have to play the odds, and we gave her chemotherapy with erlotinib. She got pemetrexed, she got cisplatin, she got erlotinib, and at some point, after we confirmed her brain was doing better following a couple of cycles of the triplet, we added in bevacizumab.
And what was the symptomatology from?
Oh, she had horrible pain in her bones, she had headaches, she'd lost weight. She had a lot of symptoms referable to her lung cancer.
So you have a 38-year-old woman that presents with explosive symptomatic adenocarcinoma of the lung. That must be kind of hard to comprehend, even more than the average newly diagnosed patient.
Yes, this is one of those ones where you don't like it when you're the attending and you're older than the patient. You feel like you're just dodging bullets. But she had a brief response on that chemo, Neil. But I had the sense we were sort of treading water. Even though the scans got a little better, she didn't feel great. She still had some pain. And we reached a critical juncture at which we saw some progression and she was really doing poorly, and we had to change her treatment.
So what chemo had she gotten initially?
She got pemetrexed, she got bevacizumab, and she got cisplatin and erlotinib.
Right, and so now she has rapid progression, and then what?
Well, the question was, should we give her a taxane or should we give her gemcitabine? Is there anything we can add to that perhaps to enhance effect? And this is more going back to just being the empiric oncologist we all were a few years ago. I said, let's give her gemcitabine and cetuximab. And the family had a lot of questions about alternative treatments, and so I felt we needed to add a biologic, and there was little to be lost. I would say in the cetuximab literature, I think the trial that holds up pretty well, even though it's not a phase 3, is the randomized phase 2, gemcitabine, a platinum with or without cetuximab. So I said, let's go for it. And, you know, the patient and family thought I wasn't being aggressive enough, but we tried this.
So that seems like a good idea. What happened?
So this is the humbling part of the whole thing. This lady, who I really thought might not even make it back to my clinic, came back with close to a complete response about 6 weeks later. And I'll just back up for a second. You know, there was one marker we hadn't been able to check for because her original tumor had been largely depleted, and that was the EML4 ALK. So we set her up to go to get a core biopsy of her liver, and the family was pushing for it. They said, just send us the bill. We'll figure it out, et cetera, et cetera. She goes into the interventional radiologist. He goes, I don't see any viable tumor. This tumor is markedly smaller than it was, and indeed, multiple passes all just revealed necrosis. So that was sort of a paradoxical event. The family was waiting to have tissue to sort of plan their next move like a chess game, and we were victims, as we rarely are, of our own success and didn't have any viable tumor to study.
So where is she right now?
She is continuing on gem and cetuximab, asking, you know, if she can get the things more frequently than she currently is. She's gained some weight. Her kids view her as more like herself. She's largely pain-free. Appetite's good. It was really just a moving experience and a humbling one because really it was just throwing darts in this case, and we managed to hit something.
So any lessons to be learned? There was a presentation from the FLEX study at ASCO looking at biomarkers. It didn't look like they really came up with much, or did you see anything there?
No, I think that the biomarker data for cetuximab to date has been unrevealing, I guess would be the best term. I'm not sure I've answered all the questions adequately or with sufficient power, but certainly it doesn't appear that there's a simple story like KRAS mutation or BRAF mutation for cetuximab in, say, colon cancer.
I mean, I don't know if we know much about BRAF in response to therapy, do we, in colon?
I don't know, but it certainly doesn't look like those patients do terribly well.
You're right. They are talking about not giving it. But I think they reported no relationship with KRAS mutation and cetuximab in that ASCO presentation. Am I right?
In the FLEX, yes.
Yeah, in FLEX. So what's the lesson to be learned here?
I think that analogies across diseases are helpful, but they're not necessarily foolproof.
And what about her brain?
Everything got better. So the other thing too, of course, and I think many oncologists have come to understand this, is that if one has a good response systemically, oftentimes that's obtained in the brain as well and can either delay or avoid the need for treating brain metastases. This lady had such virulent disease, there wasn't really time to break and give her a radiotherapy and then come back 2 weeks later to attack the rest of the cancer.
I think I remember you mentioning to me something about the idea of combining erlotinib and cetuximab, which sort of makes sense. Do we know anything about that?
So we're conducting a phase 1 2 study of cetuximab with erlotinib in what we call acquired resistance, those EGFR-addicted patients. And hopefully we'll have some results to show on that in the not-too-distant future.
What's it been like for this woman and her family?
Roller coaster. Absolute roller coaster, both emotionally. And I think one thing that's not well understood or appreciated, or sometimes we lose sight of, is the individual is fighting multiple battles. Of course, there's the battle against the cancer, but there's the battle to expedite things. There's the battle of the insurance. There's the battle of the logistics, particularly for patients who are pushing for a little more and or their family trying to be the patient advocate. You know, how do I get Dr. Miller to work with the interventional radiologist, to work with the pathologist, to send a gram of my tumor to someone at Dana-Farber who says they'll do a certain analysis in 10 days' time and that my guide has had to best treat things. And I think one of my jobs is to try to assess when there could be some merit to that or when it's just not going to be helpful either for timeline reasons or because we've exploited most of the therapies that could be relevant to that analysis anyway.
How does she do in terms of side effects and treatment?
Oh, you know, this is one of the pearls of what we deal with every day is the side effects paled in comparison to the benefit and the erasing or removal or ameliorating of her symptoms from her cancer. She was happy to deal with a little rash and diarrhea.
Did she have much of a rash?
She had a modest rash. It wasn't the worst I'd seen. It was probably in the 50th percentile.
We talked before about this exciting data coming out with the ALK fusion mutation, and you were trying to get tissue in this situation, I guess, on the possibility it might be positive you could try another drug. In what situations do you do it? Was this sort of sparked by her age and the attitude of her and her family or something more medical?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you look at the abstract presented at ASCO this year, you'll see that the frequency of this abnormality in patients who are never smokers and EGFR and KRAS wild type is as high as 25%. So if you want to start doing it in some population and she fit those criteria, that would be the group in which to look for this marker. I mean, at some point, we may be able to do it more widely and pick up the surprise cases like with EGFR testing. But if there's a patient for whom you should lobby, it's the young patient, particularly a non-smoker, never smoker, who had no demonstrable EGFR or KRAS mutation.
And you couldn't go back and do that assay on the tumor that was originally biopsied?
You can do it from paraffin, but her paraffin had been completely exploited. I think part of it was because it was a bony lesion, and there's difficult to do FISH tests on that. And we do a FISH test for ALK, and also some other tests had already been done.
Now, if you do find someone with this ALK fusion mutation, how do you get the drug or the drugs?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Number one is you were having a gangbuster response to therapy X, I wouldn't pull the plug on anything at that point. But when she progressed, I think one looks for the trials of these drugs, and there is a trial open of the drug PD-1066 that's looking for patients who have that genotype. The drug that targets this ALK fusion, PD-1066, was, I think, in large part designed initially to hit tumors that are either mutated or amplified for MET, and just through almost serendipity, was also found to inhibit this other mutated kinase, EML4-ALK. So by definition, you know, all MET inhibitors will not routinely inhibit ALK. It so happens that it's a property of this particular one. It could be a property of some others. It's just a question of how the inhibitor looks to the binding site for that kinase. Just as GIST tumors are completely unrelated to BCR-ABL leukemia until we learn that one drug happens to work well in both entities.
But in terms of what the MET pathway is, what is it? Or is it a pathway?
So MET is a proto-oncogene. Its ligand is what's called hepatocyte growth factor, or HGF, or scatter factor. When activated, it promotes a number of the hallmarks of malignancy. Generally, MET is not mutated in solid tumors, although papillary renal cancers can have MET mutations. I believe that's the only common solid tumor with a high frequency of MET mutation, and I'm not sure exactly what that number is.
So this was a situation of serendipity that this drug for this pathway happens to hit the ALK kinase?
Yes, and ALK has been of interest recently because it's been identified as mutant in some hereditary or many hereditary neuroblastomas. So again, we see the linkage across seemingly unrelated tumors, neuroblastoma, certain lymphomas. ALK stands for activated lymphoma kinase, and a subset of lung cancers.